Good evening. This is Mitch Miller at Sadie's East in New York, where I'm gathered with three very fine, very different performers, each of whom has a distinct and private approach to the art of comedy. Stuart Metz, may we have their names, please?
Yes, indeed, Mitch. Tonight, as each week at this same time, CBS Radio brings you The Mitch Miller Show. Joining Mitch at a private party here at the New York theatrical restaurant Sardi's East is the star of the new Broadway hit, Rhinoceros, Zero Mostel. Carol Channing's co-star in her revue, Showgirl, Jules Munchen. And the new pretty star of the MGM film, Where the Boys Are, Paula Prentice. And now, here are Paula Prentice, Jules Munchen, Zero Mostel, and radio's most listened to host of the famous and the fascinating, the Beard himself, Mitch Miller.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you two grizzled veterans to a newcomer to the ranks of comedy. Paula Prentice, who can be as funny as she is pretty, believe it or not. Zero, I thought I detected maybe a flicker of doubt. Do you think it's impossible to be pretty and at the same time make people laugh?
Do something funny.
Do something funny. I knew it was coming. Listen, I'm going to take another drink. That's it.
Whoops.
Z, no, really, Z, do you think it's hard to be pretty and be funny at the same time?
Look at me.
No, that's the exception to the rule. I think that it's a great thing to be pretty. The great clowns are always rather good-looking.
Carol Lombard?
Carol Lombard, and among the males, Chaplin is a very handsome man. And therefore, it helps.
And Kay Kendall.
And Kay Kendall, yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh, you're in the female department. I can't think of a girl at the moment. Francis Miller was a great comic.
Well, Paula, the studio drum beaters are getting so adept at making up Cinderella stories that I find it hard to separate the facts. I know you've made one picture, you have a starring role, and it opened this week at the Radio City Music Hall. And everyone who's seen you predicts a great future, and that much is true. How about the rest? Did you really have no previous experience except for school dramatics and the Summer of Stock?
Yes, that's right. I had 2 years of summer stock, 2 summers, and 3 years at Northwestern University. I'm glad that I had that when an opportunity like this would come along.
Well, Northwestern must be quite a school. They've turned out 4 or 5 movie stars, haven't they? The dramatic school has.
Yes, They have a lot of young people who were just in my class who are here now and working in shows.
Pat Neal came from there?
Pat Neal, Nancy Dussault now is in Do-Re-Mi and
Charlton
Ron
Heston.
Charlton Heston.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, what does school dramatics consist of at Northwestern?
Well, it consists of a kind of a rigorous plan in this way that you don't go to books to find out. You have to get up on the stage, and Alvina Krauss, who is the teacher, propels you into doing something if she has to get up there and hit you. But even though she uses these kind of methods, in a sense, she is too concerned with the fact that you, first of all, think about the audience and what you want them to see and hear.
Sounds like an actor's studio, academic actor's studio.
Well, I don't know what you mean by academic.
The fact that it's a school.
Yes.
Which is subject to the academic requirements. And it's very similar to the actor's studio.
With discipline.
It is, but except for, I think it is in this sense that... I think Miss Krauss is dealing with young people, and she's working with them over a period of 3 years, which is a terribly short time to try to get across to them every phase of drama. And so she starts with one concept, and that is try to believe it yourself. But she, too, has to go into a lot of things, like she tries a little musical comedy, a little Shakespeare, all of these things, which get out, really, from realism.
Well, how did MGM find you?
Somebody... saw me on the campus of Northwestern. I was doing a scene from A Hat Full of Rain, which wasn't comedy at all. And it was a representative from the MGM office here. And he said he liked me afterwards. He believed what I was doing, which made me feel good. But I didn't expect to hear anything from him. And I heard from him the very day I was leaving school. I had packed my trunks and sent him here to New York. And I heard from him that afternoon at 4 o'clock. He said, can you do comedy? And I said, I'm going to, I've got to, now that this thing has come. And he said, okay, you have to get on the plane in the morning at 8:30.
That was last June, and your film, Where the Boys Are, is already out. Things must have moved fast. Did they just toss you in front of the cameras and start filming as fast as that?
Almost. Mm-hmm. Almost. We had about a week.
Julie Munchen, do you have any general fatherly advice for Paula based on your years of service to movie acting, some of it with MGM?
Well, I think... that the play is the thing, and studying and working and being an artist is a whole trick. All the other things are very secondary. I think to be a devoted artist is the...
Yes, I do.
That's
fatherly enough, Jules. Paula must be as tall as the gal you're playing opposite on Broadway now, Carol Channing. Is acting with tall gals tough on the actor, Jules Munchen?
If you're short, I suppose. No, if you really act, you act.
Well, you seem to run the size gamut with actresses. You also did a play with Helen Hayes.
Yes, Ruth Gordon, Audrey Hepburn.
Tiny Tim.
I did a play with Zero Mostel. There's no shorter girl than that.
Paul Apprentice, did people try to discourage you by saying you were too tall for acting?
Well, no, not really.
Big enough for me.
I mean, yeah, I thought in about the third grade. I tell you, I looked around and I was bigger than everybody else. About the 10th or 11th grade.
I know how you felt. I was wider than
everybody else. Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
Well, Zero Mostel.
I was astigmatic.
Despite your enormous talent, I'll bet to this day you're not sure that acting is for you. I think you do it so that you'll be free during the day when you've got the right light for
this
it.
This I gotta hear. Go ahead.
Am I far wrong?
Well, no, because do you want a light?
I thought I would. Yes, I'm sorry.
I'll give the lady a light.
My son Munchen here will give her a light. What did you ask?
I said, actually, you're a wonderful painter.
Yes.
And I was asking whether acting is really for you, or do you think that you're doing it only so that you'll be free during the day? When you got the right light for it, meaning painting.
I've been known to act during the day, too, and paint at night, so...
He's an extraordinary painter, you know. Have you seen his work?
Logical. Mitchell is a collector of mine.
Oh, is he?
And paid up. Not like you, Munchen. The point is that today is an age of specialization in all things, and I think... There's just not enough in acting. I like to do something else. Mm-hmm. During the day, otherwise you spend all your time in Sardis East. I thought if you could do something, and I have a bent for painting, so I want to paint, I want to act, I want to be a banker too, but no one let me.
Well, you're truly a wonderful painter, Z. As you've said, I've got five of Z's smaller works hanging in my apartment, all paid up, and I get the same charge out of them I do when I watch him perform. Zero, with your ability as a painter, where did you ever find the time to learn to be an actor?
The reason I became an actor is because I thought it was a very lucrative profession. And I got a job as a comedian many years ago, and I thought I would make enough money to paint. And the first day I was, first week's salary provided me with paints for a long time, and so I didn't act for a while. Then that ran out, and then I acted some more, and did some more comedic work, until now I'm both broke in acting and painting.
Zero Mostel, how did you first break into the business, your first job?
My first job, I was a comedian in a nightclub, never having had any previous experience or studied at Northwestern or other great educational institutions. I was an English major in school, and having a fair command of the language, I went on a stage at the Cafe Society downtown, the first thing I ever did.
You mean when I saw you down in Cafe Society, that
yes.
was your first
job? It was
job.
The first job, yes.
Then you have to do the voice you used as the Australian bird caller.
Yes.
What was that voice? Do a couple of...
A bird call.
No, but the man who does the talking.
Oh, yes. I could hardly talk after that.
He used to give a lecture on birds.
Yes, the Royal Academy of Sciences, a place which I never visited.
And tell us how that ornithologist sounded.
He said, "My dear friends, I come here today to discuss to you the mating cry of the Egyptian auk, which is something like this." Very often it scared me.
It scared us too, and the engineer probably has turned the pot
How's
way down.
How's your needle?
Nanzero Mostel, now that you're on Broadway in a hit, Rhinoceros, the management won't run ads quoting the critics' praise. Now, what's happened there?
He's a nut.
Tell us about it.
Well, he's a nut, though rather likable. I use the term nut
lovingly.
Lovingly, yes. Of course, because it's a type of play which the usual run of Broadway producer would not do. And Kurz, our producer, the Filbert, did it. But he is also against a commercialism in the theater. He thinks you should only do good plays. And so he feels that when you excerpt a quote from a review, you don't give a real picture of the review. He thinks that's dishonest, which is, you know, a laudable thing, I suppose, if it didn't happen to this show. But it's gotten rave reviews, and he doesn't use them because he feels he should not excerpt. He should give the complete picture.
Well, why doesn't he print the whole review?
Then he would have to take 10 or 12 pages of the Times or other dailies, but and it would be prohibitive. The expense would be prohibitive. So instead, he publishes a brochure with all the reviews, whether they're favorable or unfavorable, which can be acquired in the lobby.
Well, that's too late already if somebody's already...
I know that. I don't think he understands very much. But I think it's, kind of insane... No, kind of, laudable thing that he's doing, I suppose. I think it'd be marvelous if one went to theater because it's a habit rather than a compulsion or somebody has forced them to go because it has the usual ingredients of a Broadway success.
Zero Mostel. Will you tell us more? Did the cast of your play go to the producer and say, won't you please print these reviews?
Yes, we went to him and asked that he print the reviews since they're very good. And he said, well, I made a statement that I wouldn't use the reviews and I won't use them. So he said, well, the livelihoods of most of the actors are involved. He says, you're getting a very good salary, maybe a little bit too much, he says to the actors. And so he just is adamant about the point. And maybe the nut will carry it through.
Well, you had full houses the last 2-3 nights, I know.
Yeah, we prefer to say so.
Zero Mostel, you can't say your moves to Broadway lack excitement. Yeah. This time, a war with the management.
Yes, I wind up with every nut in show business.
And last time, you were supposed to star in a Broadway play.
I even worked with Julie Munchen once.
And the last time you were supposed to star in a Broadway play, you were hit by a bus or a truck, weren't
yes.
you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, God. Yes.
Well, that play was the Good Soup, wasn't it?
The Bon Soup, yeah, The Good Soup, which Gar Kanin directed. And Munchen, by the way, was not the driver of the bus.
I want to tell you something.
He did get my part.
Let me tell you something. In Beverly Hills, California, they came with that part, and I didn't like it. And then after you got hit by a bus, I figured it must be something good, so I took the part.
And I also have a feeling probably the cause of the accident, is to my left here. Because I understand you made an unexpressed thought, which you said to a mutual friend, I hope a bus hits him. And it did.
No, I said, I hope my bus hits him.
Julie Munchen, I don't suppose you encountered any perils of that sort on the road to Broadway. Just a nice, dull succession of personal triumphs. The first was Call Me Mister, wasn't it?
Well, there was a... Yeah, I did an army show before that. There have been ups and downs. It isn't all what you say.
But
career is like a mountain range, you know. It has to have ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Call Me Mister was my first show.
And you've also done well in the field that Paul Apprentice is breaking into, screen comedy. Julie, do you find it a lot harder to be funny before a camera than in front of a live audience?
He finds it hard all the time. Oh, no, go on, Julie. Answer in your own way.
I do. No, I think it's the same thing. I think there's a technique you use for the... No, you play, that's all.
You make sure the front of your face is facing the camera is a very good idea, don't you think?
Well, Paula
he doesn't think so.
Paula, Joe Pasternak, who sang your praises here a week or two back, said you were an absolute natural your first time in front of the camera, as though you'd lived with it all your life. How'd you keep
how
from
do you
being...
know she has? Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, how'd she keep
would you
from
go
being
out with me tonight? No, my camera won't let me.
How did you keep from being thrown by that mechanical monster?
Well, to tell you the truth, it was... I never had really any conception of what a soundstage looked like. And I remember when I started working, I seemed to be much more at ease because nobody's paying any attention to you, for one thing. The cameraman, even as close as he is, and the cameras and all of that, is tending his own business, and therefore I felt completely relaxed for that reason. It wasn't a frightening thing. The frightening thing was anticipating what it would be like.
You're taking a breath, Julie Munchen. What are you going
to
say?
Well, I think as time goes on, you sort of get adjusted to the whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a job.
That's right.
Sure,
and that's exactly what I saw. You know, when I went in there, I felt, my God, here it is, and I've got to do something gigantic. But it's no more than playing
and also,
a scene.
Sort of trickery enters into it, and a knowledge of yourself enters into it. My last picture was...
Self-abuse, various other
I'm not going to pay because he's a tap-dancing fool. I won't pay any attention. The last picture, there was Fred Astaire, and this is just marvelous to watch. He is so skilled.
Julie, this is by no means your first effort in this treacherous field. I mean the field of reviews. I think reviews have a higher mortality rate than any form of theater. Why do you think this is so?
Because it's good.
No, I mean, why do more reviews go down the drain?
Well, because the curtain goes up and down 30 times in a show. Zero was in a great review some years ago. You know, 20 times. In a play, you go up once, you come down at the end of the first act, you go up again. But every 5 minutes, the curtain's coming down and people can get restless. You really gotta hit them all the time. You can't stop. You can be dull in a play a little
while. No, I think it's usually the content of the review because the humor isn't of a high standard. They don't spoof anything, really. The humor comes off cute. Rather
yes,
than biting or satirical.
Well, humor can come off cute in a straight play if it has enough
slick
tricks.
No, we're talking about a review, though.
Well,
and I think very often there are too many jokes about ourselves rather than to
well,
what
has
people
to have a point
want
of
to
view.
See lampooned. Yeah.
The reason
mm-hmm.
Call Me Mister was probably the greatest review of our time is that it had one point of view, the army.
And it was political.
Yes, yeah. And was
that's
political.
That's why it was yeah. good.
Yes, do you sir. Find that doing a review... in doing a review, you can't always predict which numbers the audience will go for. A sketch may bomb one night and be a great success the next.
No. When you get the regular audience, you kind of know exactly. The first couple of nights, you get the whoopsies, I call them. Some of those nuts coming from the Upper East Side, you know.
Kurz went to see it?
No. And they scream it up, you know. But when you get a real sober audience, they laugh the same place all the time.
Paula Prentice, anything you care to get off your chest about reviews?
When you say that you can, why certain reviews aren't successful, when you say that Marlene Dietrich one, I remember I saw, I don't know.
I didn't see, I'm not.
It isn't the same review, as you said a minute ago, that is showing now.
No.
But I saw Carol Channing in that, and when she did Marlene Dietrich, I don't know, when she put her leg to one side, that caught it right in an essence. No. And some of them, I know that I have seen... outside of this show, don't quite catch one thing like that. That is her.
You have to be very.
And they
skilled,
do resort yeah. to a low kind of comedy that misses what you are expecting as an audience member.
Well, Zero Mostel, tell us something about Rhinoceros, the play you're starring in with Eli Wallach. I know it's by Europe's most imaginative playwright, Eugene Ionesco.
Is that Ionesco.
Ionesco. And that it has to do with people turning into rhinoceroses.
Well,
and that's as much as I do know. I've seen it, but I'm saying this for our audience. Tell me more. What's it all about?
Actually, it's a story that probably ties up with the notions we've talked about in about review. It talks about it. The narrative is that a rhinoceros invades a town, and since it becomes fashionable to become a rhinoceros, since he's the ugliest, clumsiest, most stupid animal on earth, that people will turn into rhinoceri if. It becomes fashionable. In other words, it's a story of conformity. Mm-hmm. But it's not as dour as that. It's actually very hilarious and funny, and there are things on the stage you've never seen before. There are wonderful comic technical things like the quartet, when two ideas are going at one time. Do you recall that?
Yes, it was like the counterpoint.
Yes, counterpoint going like music. He would see his music, and I saw it as plumbing.
Eli Wallach and his wife, Ann Jackson,
yes,
have 25 years of marriage in 2.5 minutes.
That's right. And
tell them about that.
That very often happens in our married life, too. You know, the great bond that you have between a woman can be shattered by a phone call, as it is, as to who should answer the phone, which is the problem in the play, you know. You answer, I'll answer. They become wild, Wilde Kaczkes. I thought I'd get
that. I knew you were going to throw them in. What is Wilde Kaczkes?
Wild Ducks.
Wild Ducks.
Oh, by Ibsen.
Famous record by Mitch.
tell me, Zero, your producer won't quote the reviews, but I'm not under that restriction. John Chapman in the news says that the best scene in the play is the one in which you turn into a rhino right on the stage. No props, no nothing. Can you give us some idea of how you go about making that transformation?
Well, actually, I don't turn into a rhinoceros, for God's sake. But I felt it. The scene actually never worked wherever it was done, you know. And it didn't work because he exited to the bathroom and put on a piece of makeup each time. Since he always goes to cool himself down, to throw water on himself. He feels hot, you know, when he turns into a beast. And I felt that you could only do it by showing it through your inner belief. And I thought if you become bestial, beast-like, then you would make a point about the play. And the Kurz and Joseph Anthony agreed with me, and we decided to do it without makeup. And I think you're fascinated by the fact that the man is going crazy, really, because that's the whole idea, you know, of turning into a rhinoceros, that you go crazy, you think you're a beast. You know, you go to any dill house and someone says, I am a kachke, or I am a panda. You know, the fellow, or he's Napoleon, or whatever he wishes to be, since he's completely free, and I wish I were there. But
you are there.
I know I'm there. What else am I doing here? And so I thought you must do it without makeup because I felt that the audience would feel if you go exit and come out with a piece of makeup, you're doing it for that reason and not because it works in the play.
That's fantastic transformation. The author of Rhinoceros was in town for a few days recently and he's written several very talked about plays in the past several years. I was wondering, Z, did you find him an interesting man to talk to?
Oh, yeah, he's a lovely man. There's not much to talk to because he's he speaks French.
Is it true that he gave a speech in French to the cast and you translated it?
In Yiddish.
That is true. Yeah. Tell
he
us
said,
about that.
Mes amis, quand je reporte à Paris, à Paris, and he asked me to translate, said, Mane tare frein tich vil arzom. And he reacts to everything like a little clown. He's wonderful. I screamed at him. You know, every little rehearsal hall has a sign that says, put the Pepsi-Cola bottles back in the rack. So when he walked and I said, did you put your Pepsi-Cola bottle back? And he went, like all sorts of gestures. And someone told me that he spoke English, and I told Kate, my wife, that she should invite him for dinner, and she gave him a lengthy proposal. And he said, scotch and soda. That's what he answers to everything. To everything he answers, scotch. And he said, how do you feel? He says, scotch and soda. That's the extent of his English. Well, he's quite a wonderful little man.
While everyone's getting in and plugged for their work, Paul Apprentice, why don't you fill us in on where the boys are? For a picture about college kids on a lark, the dialogue's a little racier than we older moviegoers are used to, isn't it?
Where is it? I'd like to go.
Where is it? Well, I guess it is. Glendon Swartz.
What time do the racy parts go on?
Well, let's see. About every 15 minutes, yeah. No, they've got Glendon Swarthout, who was a college professor and who wrote the original book, said that he got all of this, he heard this kind of talk on the campus, and he put it into the book, and then the screenwriter, George Wells, took the parts that he could and took the parts that he could take to put on the screen.
I
and
would
use
like
them.
To shoot the parts that weren't used.
That weren't used, that's right. Read the book.
Well, how'd you like the location work at Fort Lauderdale with those thousands of college kids swirling around on the beach?
Well, they weren't really there, but they recreated the whole scene. They'd planned to use that beach during spring vacation when the college students were there, but the actors were on strike, so we went down again at the end of June, and they recreated it.
Paula, now that you're an overnight celebrity with your name hanging over the Radio City Music Hall, how do you convince the kids back at Northwestern and the gang back home in Tulsa that you're the same modest, sensible gal you always were, that you're not high-hatting them, that you haven't gone Hollywood as they feared?
Listen, I'm scared. I am, and that's about the same as I've always been.
Mm-hmm. No special way that you can act when you go back
home.
Now,
you're a tall girl. Don't be scared.
That's, well, now, I've adjusted to that. I've had that for quite a while.
Yeah,
this is a new thing.
Don't be afraid of it. Just go high hat and don't talk to him.
You that's right. Don't talk. I mean, give him a
and
show.
And that's my fatherly advice to you.
Julie Mutchett, did you run into this problem, the first flush of success? Your friends thinking that maybe you were snubbing them?
No, I was scared, too.
I never spoke to you.
I was scared, too. That's a normal process to be scared.
Yeah.
Jules Munchen, I've forgotten your beginnings in this business. How old were you when you were bitten by the show business bug?
Zero's age. I was quite young. I started as a drummer, you know. Then I became a saxophone player, and then I realized I had no talent for that.
You got all those jobs, Mitch.
I was quite young. It's an affliction. All acting is an affliction, you know. You have to do it.
Go on.
And I started in school, and I played in all kinds of clubs, cellar clubs, and I went and played in the mountains.
I was going to ask you about that, because everyone's read Moss Hart's bestseller, Act One, in which
yes.
he describes the nightmare life of a funny man on the summer resort circuit in the mountains.
Yes.
Did you go through the tortures Moss describes as an apprentice?
Well, I
in
didn't
Washington?
Play. Apparently, he played places that were of a lower caliber than the places I played. But I went through the same thing, yes.
For instance, he worked Bumpf.
Uh-huh. Well, Zero, what about you? Do you have any stories of cruel hotel owners or poor food for the help?
No, one story I always liked is the owner of the Concord, who was a rather fine fellow, Arthur Venerick, was to build a golf course and to attract customers. And he called in Tull, who was a very famous Scottish landscape artist, to build a golf course. And he said to Tull, he says, how many holes has Grossinger got? And Tull looked at him and said, 18. So he says, build me a course with 50 holes. So he said to him, but you don't build a course. The nature of the game is such you must have 18 holes, you know, in Scotsman. And he says, if Grossinger's got 18, I want 19, 20, 21, 22. So they built two courses.
He's a wonderful man.
Yes, a wonderful.
Well, kids, we've come just about to the end of our allotted time here on the network. Anyway, two of you have got to go scooting off to the theater. Zero Mostel, congratulations on your virtuoso performance in Rhinoceros with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, a funny and stimulating adventure in the theater. And Julie Munchen, a long run to you and Carol Channing in Showgirl. Two very funny people in a rare New York appearance. And Paul Apprentice, you don't need my blessing. Your star is rising like a ballistic missile after Where the Boys Are. And I'll be watching eagerly for your next film. Meanwhile, this one's very, very good.
Thank you.
To my listeners, I'll be back next week at the same time with some new guests, and I'll be most happy to have you join me again. Z, what do you have to say?
I thought Julie and I did rather well at Miss Prentice.
Yeah, I thank you all. Just delightful.
I would like to come back next week. I understand we get a free meal.
Well, until next week, this is Mitch Miller from Society's East in New York. Say good night and have a good week. Thank you.